Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So tomorrow I have to go to Spirit Rock and lead a day long on sort of desire or aspiration. So that has got me pondering, thinking, reflecting, so that I've got something to say tomorrow. So that usually what happens is at Spirit Rock they'll send a bunch of titles for the day long, and I'll choose them, and then Ajahn Gurudharma will write up some kind of a summary. And then I'll teach around that. So tomorrow, it's just that thing of around desire, sort of, is a Buddha supposed to have any desires? Or can they have any desires? Because, you know, there is a certain assumption that the Buddha, in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha points to the fact that desire is the cause of suffering, and that the cessation of suffering comes through relinquishment of desire. So one assumes that, and okay, if I've got to relinquish desire, then I guess I can't have any desires. And I think that that's a misunderstanding of the Buddha's teaching, and a misunderstanding of the nuances of desire, because if we didn't conceive of a desire for peace or a desire for true happiness, then we couldn't do much of anything, really. It's desire is a motivating force, but the question is not so much can Buddhists have desire or not. It's the question is more around how do we cultivate skillful desire and relinquish unskillful desire. That's much more the question, or the basis of how we practice, how we reflect, how we cultivate the path, so that being able to recognize that with a skillful and wholesome application of desire, we can achieve a result. And I think it's important to pay attention to what result are we looking for? Because if we're looking for, say, just gratification, looking for some sort of fleeting pleasure, or some kind of selfish something that has a selfish motivation, then there's going to be a problem with that. It's going to create suffering for oneself. It'll create suffering for others, and of course, that's even if there's a certain amount of pleasure involved or happiness, because there is a certain happiness that comes, say, just from kind of getting angry and blowing up at somebody. There's a certain happiness that comes from it, which is usually pretty short-lived and has pretty painful repercussions. So that being able to sort of say, okay, well, that really didn't work, I got to figure out a better way to find happiness in this. So on the human level, where there's all these, on a certain level, there's all these conflicting desires, and being able to understand them more clearly, understand how they work and how they function, and being able to support that. And this is where, say, like in the Buddha's teaching, just the word in the language that the Buddha used, there's a couple different words for desire. So that in the Four Noble Truths, when the Buddha speaks of desire, then desire is the cause of suffering. Then the word he uses is tanha, and that's a desire that's always linked with greed, hatred, and delusion, and it always ends up in some kind of state of dissatisfaction or suffering. But there's also desire that is that the Buddha recommends. So, like in the four bases of spiritual success, the Iddhipadas. And they're part of the, say, the factors of awakening, or the Bodhipakya Dhamma. They're the wings to awakening. The first quality that the Buddha encourages is something that he calls chanda, which is desire. Literally translated as desire, but it's a desire that's more of a motivation and a wholesome. It's generally a wholesome desire. So desire for the skillful, the good, kusala chanda, dhamma chanda, desire for truth, desire for dhamma. That's a skillful desire. It can be unskillful. Like in the five hindrances, the very first hindrance is kamachanda, which is sensual desire. But if it's on its own, it's generally, say, just chanda, then it's a kind of desire that is motivation, interest, and that's essential. Without a motivating interest, a motivating desire, then we don't actually do much, if we don't do anything, this the Buddha's path is a path of action, of effort, of energy. One has to put forth some energy, sometimes there's people who sort of say, like, a spiritual path should really be one of non-effort, everything should be effortless. But even on a basic level, we have to put effort. And it's like you've got food sitting out in front of you. One practices the path of non-effort and just sit there and watch it. And it's not really useful. It smells good, but it doesn't really satisfy. There has to be some effort put in order to actually bring it up to one's mouth, chew it, swallow it. It all takes effort. Or that effort of making choice, and it's kind of dualistic, so that one, really a non-dual approach would be much more kind of inspiring or useful. But, you have to make choices. That's the reality of human existence. If you've got, you go to see a doctor or you have surgery, you have some sort of, and you've got a non-dual doctor, who doesn't make choices. I mean, well, you're in deep shtuk. You know, it's a skill to be able to apply discernment and wisdom and be able to make skillful choices and to act on them. And this is where desire, being able to cultivate desire, is a part of the path. How do we motivate ourselves to practice? How do we motivate ourselves to reflect and investigate? How do we motivate ourselves to exercise restraint? Because on a certain level, you know, a lot of stuff looks good, but we have to really apply discernment and exercise restraint in many ways in order to live a life that doesn't stir us up and complicate our lives. So this sense of desire is very much a part of our practice, of our training, and of the Buddha's way. But it's learning and understanding the implications of those desires. Well, there's a very beautiful sutta where a disciple of the Buddha is on alms round, receiving a meal, and the donor asks a question, saying that there is a, amongst the religious seekers of the day, there was a belief that, or within the culture at the time, and amongst some of the religious seekers, because there was a doctrine of non-action, like you don't do anything, in saying that, and so that's like a doctrine of radical passivity, and that is how one becomes, or how one exists in the world. But you're saying that there is a whether one conceives of a desire and wishes for some kind of awakening, there isn't a fruit or benefit that comes from it. Not bringing up a kind of desire and motivation, there wouldn't be a result. And of course, it goes through the classical Indian quadrilemma of having conceived a desire, not conceiving, and neither conceiving nor not conceiving. That Indians never leave it a stone unturned in their logic. And saying, what would the Buddha say to this? And the monk was very humble, and he said, "Well, I don't know for sure, but I would think that is not so much whether one conceives of desire or not. It's whether or not one has appropriate desires." Formulating an appropriate motivation or appropriate desire, and when one has that appropriate desire that leads to appropriate action of the Eightfold Path, of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration, if one does that, then one would experience the fruits of awakening. And whether one conceived of a desire and desired for liberation or not, if one had approached it in an inappropriate way, in a wrong Eightfold Path, then there wouldn't be results come from that. It was more around having established oneself in the path or not and acted on it. So that was more the say, the results of, say, one's spiritual practice are not so much in terms of the how one conceiving of the desire, but in the implementation of it and being able to bring forth the Eightfold Path, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And it's that living of it and the doing of it that is the basis of the creating the fruit of the practice. So that I think that's a important basis and perspective that runs through the Buddha's teachings. And after he received his meal, and of course the donor thought that was a good answer, the monk went back to the monastery and approached the Buddha and related the story, and the Buddha approved of it and said, yes, that's exactly it. That is in accordance with what I would say. It's in accordance with Dhamma, in accordance with truth. But then the Buddha went on to illustrate that. He said, in the same way that because even if one conceived of, say, one had a desire for oil, in the sense cooking oil, and one had a desire for cooking oil, and one searched for cooking oil, one went looking for cooking oil, and one got some gravel and put it into a pot and pounded it and sprinkled water on it and pounded it some more. Didn't matter how much effort you expend, you're not going to get oil out of it. You're not going to get cooking oil out of it. And of course, the opposite is true in the sense that, you know, whether one conceived of a desire for it, but if one took sesame, a whole bunch of sesame seeds, put them in a pot, pounded them, sprinkled water, kept pounding them, strained it, you would get cooking oil out of it. It's in the action of it, the doing of it, and the result will naturally come. And the Buddha also gave an illustration said if one wants milk and one conceives of the idea of wanting milk and desired milk, search for milk, look for milk, and then found a newly calved cow, and then stood there twisting its horns, then one wouldn't get any milk. It says you've sort of almost, but not quite. So that even if one has that desire, has that motivation, puts forth that effort, but it's just not the appropriate method. So then the appropriate method, of course, would be to find the cow, but then to be able to squeeze its udders and milk the cow. That would be an appropriate method, and one would get milk, and it's more the method as opposed to the desire. Of course, the desire forms a motivating force behind that, but then one has to have the appropriate method, the proper way. And the Buddha also says as if one were, someone were looking for butter, and one just took some water, and then sprinkled more water on it, and took a churning stick and twirled it. Now that's how they did it in India. Actually, still today, sort of like an orange with half the segments taken out, and then they'll get curd to do it the proper method. you actually have to get curd, and then because what they call butter in India is actually lasts a bit longer. It's a bit different than butter in what we think of butter in the West. But that method of with a churning stick and churning it, twirling it, then it separates out and a butter-like substance arises. So again, needing the proper method, having the appropriate means. And then the Buddha also said, if one wanted fire, one was in need of fire, and one got a fire stick, because this is 2,500 years ago, they didn't have big lighters or matches. They would take a fire stick and then rub it on another stick. But he said, if you take a fire stick and then rub it on a wet, sappy piece of wood, you'll never get fire. It's not the appropriate method. It's not going to work. But if one took a fire stick that one rubs with and then took a dry stick and then rub that, then one could produce fire. So that this sense of the what is most important is the appropriate means and the effort put into it, the path, and particularly from the Buddha's teaching, then the foundation is the Eightfold Path. This path of practice, path of training, relying on precepts, on virtue, on integrity, in conduct of body and speech, a training in the steadiness and stability, stillness and clarity of the mind, and the discernment and wisdom. Those factors need to be there. We need to know how to bring those into being, and if something is, say, some factor is out of balance or is not there, then it doesn't bear fruit. It doesn't bring one to a place of awakening or peace or real freedom. And you see, in some suttas in the discourses, there's rather than the Eightfold Path, they talk about the Tenfold Path. So that, say, right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. It goes on to two more factors, right knowledge and right liberation. And that's important to be recognizing, because if it's that Eightfold Path coming to fruition in, say, right knowledge, knowledge that allows one to relinquish the cause of suffering and liberating the heart, because if there's a wrong application, then the knowledge that arises is not right. And if the knowledge that arises is not right, then the liberation is not right. And I think that's where that reflecting on, not so much into, say, right and this is, kind of absolutely right and this is absolutely wrong. You get it right, you get a prize. You get it wrong, you get criticized for you. But it's more like, what's actually efficacious for what we desire? Well, of course, what we desire is happiness. It's the way we function. Where we want to be happy, we want to avoid suffering. I mean, nobody's, just even when we conceive of a desire and it blows up in our face and we suffer over it, that isn't the original motivation. The motivation is always, how do we maximize happiness and minimize suffering? But if we don't understand it, we don't see it clearly, we haven't reflected on it, haven't really figured out, yeah, what are the appropriate means? What is the kind of the correct methodology? Then we end up back in that place of discontent and dissatisfaction again. So in our practice, that kind of desire and aspiration is really important to pay attention to, because it, we have to have the kind of imagination, or maybe even the courage, to imagine and desire, or to desire and aspire to something that's really, say, that's noble, that's liberating. Say, if all we sort of formulate a desire for or aspire to, how can I just put up with this? it's kind of it doesn't lift the heart up. And I think, that's something that, reflecting on the Buddha, maybe something that's really incredibly special is that the Buddha formulated the desire for freedom from suffering, and he never cut corners, and he never gave up until he really found it. And that's, we have the opportunity to say reap the fruits of his aspiration and his dedication to following that desire. Because I don't know about you all, but I know that I'm quite happy to cut corners sometimes. I think we're as human beings, we're this is just too difficult. Oh, why do I have to do this? But it's that when we think of it, what is the, to be able to aspire to something that's truly, truly noble, truly peaceful, then we have to up our game a bit. And I think that's being willing to reflect and investigate that nature of desire and how to support our practice through maybe desiring something a bit more appropriate, a bit more, say, bigger. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.
Cool.